From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings, the image of the physician in American society. That's the topic this week on Soundings. My guests are Nancy King and Larry Churchill, both members of the Department of Social and Administrative Medicine at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Nancy King and Larry Churchill specialize in medicine, law, and bioethics. How best should we account for the moral and cultural authority of the profession of medicine in the United States? How has the role of the physician in American society changed over the last 50 years? Finally, how does American medicine as an institution set standards for itself with respect to technology, the expectations of patients, and medical administration? Nancy King and Larry Churchill participated in a symposium at the University of North Carolina entitled "The Physician as Captain of the Ship, a Critical Reappraisal." Among the topics for discussion were the physician and technological change, the marketing of modern healthcare, bioethics, and nursing and the profession of medicine. Here is Nancy King.
Well, I think the interesting thing about the physician's image is that it's maybe one image and maybe a number of different images at once. The metaphor that I chose for the conference, the physician as captain of the ship, originally stems from a legal notion, which gave the operating room physician total responsibility for those things which went wrong during the operation. That was sort of a standard legal agency notion, but the metaphor was so nice that it has kind of carried over into the way we view physicians today, which is as a figure with a great deal of power and responsibility alone in that responsibility, and he may be a good guy or a bad guy. One of the interesting things that's happening nowadays is that when we look at technical changes in medical practice and economic and financial changes, that same image may be a bad guy image in some contexts and a good guy image in other contexts.
Mm-hmm. Larry Churchill, following up what Nancy King has just said, again, around this notion of authority, we could talk at institutional, technical, economic, cultural levels. Is there one of those which is most important in terms of the way the image of the physician has changed in our society?
I think it's hard to pinpoint any of those and say this is the major change that we're experiencing in terms of the authority that the physician has. To me, it's sort of helpful to think about this in terms of the images we have of who the physician is. And one of the stories I like a lot, which helps to explain the way in which we vest physicians with authority, is one taken from Greek mythology, actually.
We're at the Humanities Center.
It's a story about Asclepius, actually, who is the Greek god of healing. Asclepius was the son of Apollo and of a mortal human mother. And so he occupied this sort of twilight zone between divinity and humanity. And Asclepian authority was really characterized by the power of Asclepius to perform enormous miraculous healing ventures in terms of the patients that he saw. And Asclepius at one point became very enamored of his own power and on a dare, actually, raised a man from the dead. This angered the gods, and Zeus killed Asclepius with a thunderbolt. It's a very kind of telling story, I think, in terms of the notion of uses of power. But typically Asclepian authority then, deriving from this kind of image of a powerful healer, has thought to contain three elements. One is the power of knowledge and the authority which comes from that knowledge. We typically think physicians have a knowledge which other people don't possess.
Yeah, we think that sometimes they're superhuman.
Yes, exactly. Another one is moral authority. Mm-hmm. We believe that physicians are seeking first and foremost the patient's good. And the third is what is typically called charismatic authority, charisma being the word which means a gift, or a divine gift, typically. And if one were to look at authority in those three ways, it seems to me that the power which is being challenged most frequently is this middle one, the moral authority, because we feel, I think, more and more ambivalent about physicians in relation to the ways in which enormous pressures are being brought to bear on them mm-hmm. by economic and changing societal standards.
Mm-hmm. Again, Nancy King and Larry Churchill, our topic is the image of the physician in American society. Larry, what you're talking about here brings to mind the word expectations. How do you work on that? Do you try to figure out what Americans' expectations are of the physician? Is that the sort of thing that medical students think about and maybe not study about? But when they go into practice, how do they approach their patients in the sense that they walk into the examination room and here's somebody who's sitting there with an illness, thinking this man or woman's going to heal me? Am I creating a straw man here that really doesn't fit into the image of the physician in our society today? Nancy?
I think that's a really interesting question, because there are so many different expectations floating around, which may be real expectations and may be ones that we just think people are going to have. We do spend a lot of time talking with our students about what they think physicians are supposed to do, and very many of them have come from physicians' families, have seen their parents in practice, and have some sense of what their parents' patients expected of them. Maybe there never was a time where our values were sufficiently uniform that we could be confident that the physician knew what we wanted, but mm-hmm. one thing that has happened recently is that technical advances have made it such that there are a lot more choices.
Mm-hmm. And on both sides of the equation, I would take it.
Yes, and the existence of those choices has unmasked some of the possible differences uh-huh. in values that may have always existed and never had an opportunity to come up before.
Right. One of the things, would it be fair, for example, Nancy King, Larry Churchill, to say that that people look at doctors today and they say, look at how much money these people make? And isn't it fair that they deliver on all of that sort of social investment? Here, for example, we're getting at this notion of the economic authority of the doctor. Is there a tension between what patients feel and think when they look at the medical profession and hope for, and then when the bill comes in the mail? Do you hear about that from the doctors, Larry Churchill?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. There's a what I would want to call a deep ambivalence
yeah.
that all of us feel, even when we recognize that it is probably contradictory. We still feel this way in our moments of wellness and feeling good and not being dependent or anxious about ourselves. We probably look at medicine one way and doctors in one kind of way. But yet when we're ill and we think we need their services,
right.
We look on them very differently. And so I think there's almost a schizophrenia in American society about radical autonomy, which is highly judgmental of professionals, all professionals, uh-huh. not just doctors. And on the other hand, a kind of radical dependency in which we would like to play a very passive role and be taken care of and hang the cost, you mm-hmm. know. No cost is too great if I'm really sick.
Right.
A friend of mine says, a medical emergency is when I'm sick. And I think we feel that way when we are really in need.
Uh-huh. Nancy King?
But I'm not sure that it's correct to call it an ambivalence in the sense that it's something that we ought to resolve. It's that the balance between the patient's choice and the physician's sense of what's best for the patient, and even in a larger sense, the balance between the societal decision to give to physicians the power to heal, when that power belonged initially to society to take care of the health and welfare of its citizens, that we grant physicians this power because of their expertise, and then we say, well, you better use it the way we want you to use it in our own interest.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a resolvable ambivalence. It's something that we have to face, and maybe face better than we have been when we flip-flop, as Larry is describing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's definitely something that we can't eradicate and we shouldn't eradicate. It's something that makes us maybe have to go in a different direction in the physician-patient relationship and in the understanding we have of physicians in mm-hmm. our society, to realize that we both have to negotiate what's going on very carefully rather than try and decide whether we want to be radical autonomists or oriented entirely toward beneficence. Mm-hmm. We can't split it up that way.
It goes to the question of uncertainty, which is not necessarily medical. That's cultural. That's mm-hmm. human. Larry Churchill?
I think Nancy's absolutely right. I would just want to say in addition on top of it's not being a resolvable question, it's also a question which has to be contextualized in terms of whether we're talking about a chronic disease process or an acute illness episode. Uh-huh. If we are wheeled into the emergency room, most of us would want to have everything possible done for us without the negotiation and subtlety of cultural and value differences. On the other hand, if we're chronically ill and we're talking about the management of a disease over many years, it's a very different kind of situation in which parity and negotiation mm-hmm. and exploration and lots of conversation is extremely important.
Mm-hmm. Larry Churchill and Nancy King from the School of Medicine at the University of North Carolina. Our topic is the image of the physician in American society. How has medical education, or how have physicians responded to what some larger changes in our culture? We could put words like civil rights, feminism, litigiousness, bioethics, things like that on the table. What's the interplay between the doctor and the larger cultural picture? Larry?
Well, I think it's fair to say that physicians always reflect the values of the larger culture in some way or another. Now, mm-hmm. precisely how they do that is subject to many variations. But one has the kind of physicians in a way that we deserve and wanted uh-huh. in this society. And if you look at medicine as a mirror image of the concerns of the larger society, in which things like rights and cost and quality of care all are enormous issues everywhere, it's not surprising then that they are major issues in medical care as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what we want to remember here is that it isn't simply a matter of finding, as you said in the first part of the program, a good guy or a bad guy. We don't just want to make physicians either heroes or victims.
Uh-huh.
And we want to work towards some kind of more realistic sense of the medical profession and all professionals really interacting with social forces in a creative rather than a simply reactive fashion, mm-hmm. so that there's a way of melding the kind of understandings of physicians to society and vice versa uh-huh. in the educational process. The idea that there could be a plan for provision of healthcare or for medical education in general is an idea which Americans are not ready to right. work with yet in a realistic way, uh-huh. unlike most other industrialized countries, which have a centralized provision for providing care and education. There's a way in which the traditions of American individualism and laissez-faire economics with mm-hmm. a kind of a Puritan ethic of self-reliance predispose us to think that that is not the way to go. And so we have, consequently, a sort of a very mixed mm-hmm. and sometimes fragmented system.
So although not necessarily willingly all the time, we have, given ourselves over to a sort of collective or a consensus mentality in which we're saying, really, we're exercising faith in the institution of medicine, that the best decisions and the right kinds of tools and products of the medical schools will be forthcoming. Do I have this right, Nancy?
Well, as a lawyer, I tend toward the notion that the authority or the chart by which the ship of medicine ought to be sailing should come directly from society,
mm-hmm.
but
rather than the doctors.
Well, that raises the problem precisely because, as I said a little while ago, politically and legally, the power to care for the health and welfare of its citizens belongs to the state, uh-huh. and the state has made a choice to delegate it to physicians and then incidentally to other kinds of health professionals.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to a discussion about the image of the physician in American society. My guests are Nancy King and Larry Churchill, both members of the Department of Social and Administrative Medicine at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. According to Nancy King and Larry Churchill, until recently, a single cultural metaphor captured the role that American society accorded to physicians. Doctors were captains of the ship, responsible finally for all that happened within the scope of their supervision. Yet today, as a result of technological, legal, and economic considerations, together with consumer choice and patients' rights, the social mandate of the physician in American culture is clearly undergoing change. Here is Nancy King.
One thing I'm going to talk about, which doesn't really have very much to do with our teaching at all, I think is a very important factor. And I think that the University of North Carolina may be doing one of the best jobs of it that's being done. And that is to select as medical students people who have been in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that makes a great deal of difference as I see the students that I'm teaching. People who have had other career experiences, who have worked, who have widely varying backgrounds, tackle the kinds of questions they need to be tackling with more confidence in some way than students who are coming straight from school where they've been going through pre-med.
Mm-hmm.
And they also help the students who have just gone straight through school to see things in a different way. What makes it difficult to do in a medical school setting is simply that it's a very different kind of learning from what else is in their curriculum. And part of our task, I think, is to enable medical students to encompass different kinds of learning and different kinds of vocabularies.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I teach is a law and medicine seminar, and rather than just teaching laws, what I attempt to do is explore the principles and the foundations of legal thinking and demonstrate to students how those fit in with good medical practice. So I've given them two sets of intellectual tools that they
mm-hmm.
can use.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's our doing that is really important because it medical students are so inundated with a particular kind of learning that to show them all through their education that there are other kinds of learning that are still useful to them is really important.
Again, Nancy King and Larry Churchill from the UNC School of Medicine, we're talking about the physician in American society, Americans' images and notions of the physician. Let's talk about medical technology. Is it fair to say that technology has outstripped the profession itself in its humanistic basis? We talked earlier about the expectations that citizens bring to the medical profession. You drive through the campus and you see all these incredible gleaming buildings full of scientists in white jackets and you think, they're solving all of our problems. That obviously is not the case. Tell me about the continuity, the tension between medicine as an institution and technology as an institution. Larry?
I think one needs to distinguish first between what one might call really effective technologies and what Lewis Thomas calls halfway technologies.
Meaning what?
Halfway technologies are those which are not curative, really, but simply slow down, perhaps, the process of disease
uh-huh.
and don't give us a nice, clean, restorative capacity to patients. They really only give us some kind of help in alleviating pain or in slowing a disease process down. Now, an example of a really clean, pure, and therefore cheap technology is something like the polio vaccine. An example of a halfway technology is something like the dialysis of the blood, which is done for people who have end-stage renal disease, where mm-hmm. their kidneys no longer can cleanse their the impurities from out of the system. And end-stage renal disease is something which is cared for under the Medicare provision, paid for by tax dollars, federal tax dollars, and yet it's a very expensive and only partially effective kind of procedure. So you might say that one of our difficulties is that we have a lot of technologies, some of which are only partially effective, and therefore we have enormous expense related to the maintenance of those technologies and the manpower to make them run.
Nancy King?
One of the questions, well, maybe the most important question that advancing technology raises is the problem, which as Larry has been describing, of the viewpoint, we will do that which can be done. Uh-huh. And the lure of technology is that technology itself provides us with that impulse. The question that's raised is whether that's always an appropriate conclusion. And what we need to face with any new technology or with any technology at all is making sure that we find an independent, a reason independent of the existence of the technology itself to say we will do that which can be done. When we make decisions about end-stage renal disease or the continuation of life support in a terminally ill patient or almost any question arising from the development of technology, I think we need different kinds of moral reasons. We need to simply sit back and say, why are we going to do this? Just because it's available, or can we find some other reason to do it? And in some cases, we may say, well, we don't have any other reason to do it, and so we won't do it. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, we may decide that we ought to go ahead and do it, but not simply because it's there to do.
Mm-hmm. Larry Churchill?
Sometimes one can talk about this, I think, in terms of the difference between either technological lag or cultural lag. Uh-huh. If you have technological lag, you have a situation in which there is a need for a technology which has not yet been developed. And clearly, in some areas, that is the case with us. In other situations, it seems to me, we have a technology, but we're not sure how to use it, what its appropriate range of use is, how frequently to use it, and when to stop using it. And we are also in that situation with regard to many of the things that medicine is now capable of doing. Mm-hmm. So that I think it is fair to talk about technology, in a sense, outstripping our moral wisdom, because we're not sure who's in control, whether right. it's ourselves and our own appropriate use of a technology, or whether the technology has a life of its own, the so-called technological imperative.
Nancy King?
It just occurred to me that another way that technology is important is that it offers an opportunity for sharing of authority. Uh-huh. One of the things most interesting about technology is that a lot of it doesn't get developed by physicians. Mm-hmm. And some kinds of advancing technology we've recognized as so important in certain ways that we don't want it to be controlled by physicians alone either. For example, genetic technologies.
Right.
So a lot of different people come into the picture at the level of development of technology, control and distribution of it, decisions whether a given hospital is going to have a particular machine, and the physician then steps in at a later point. In a way, one could say that the physician's area of authority gets circumscribed by technological development when other people get involved. But it also provides us with the opportunity, if we're looking for a societal consensus on a given issue, it provides us with the opportunity to do that because so many more people see the need to be involved in making decisions about given technologies.
Mm-hmm. In other words, it's not fair to isolate medicine and bring to it unrealistic expectations, apart from the way we would look, for example, at environmental issues or political issues. We have to bring the same sensibility to them all. I got that right?
Yes.
Larry?
It seems to me that the most important question facing the medical care system and also society as it involves medical care today is the question of who's going to get medical care, mm-hmm. and what kind of system we will have in terms of its equity and its availability.
Who's going to make those decisions, the doctors or the state legislatures or the federal government? What's the interplay?
Historically, we have said that we will let physicians decide that in relation to a free enterprise or laissez-faire medical care system, so that we will give medical care to those who can pay for it, and then we will supply a sort of backup philanthropy or social security system that will give care to some people who can't afford it, or some people with the particular kinds of diseases or social backgrounds. But the safety net, the so-called safety net, which provides care for people who can't get it, is shrinking. Mm-hmm. And as a result, the health of many people is being affected. For example, we're now seeing infant mortality rates rising after they had declined for decades.
That would have been the product of the Great Society programs.
That's exactly right. And so that there are something like 25 million people in this country who have no health insurance whatever, and those people get inferior care. And the question I'm raising is a question of social ethics, a question of justice, and it concerns all of us insofar as we're all citizens of a society.
Mm-hmm. Nancy King, how about it? Is there a single issue that springs to mind? Again, your perception of medicine from the standpoint of somebody who teaches medical students and then who observes the institution itself.
Well, something that I see as particularly important, which is nicely complementary to what Larry said, I think, is at an individual level, the problem of facing a decision as to things we might choose to forego, or the problem of facing death. We talked some about technology and the role of technology in pulling us along on the road of doing that which we can do. And I think that one of the things that we find very difficult to do is to say, stop, no, I choose not to have this, or to listen to people when they say, stop, I choose not to have this. And it's, of course, it isn't true that if you decide that you're not going to take that kidney transplant that you could otherwise get, that that money will find its way into the healthcare of somebody that needs it. I think it's nevertheless important for individuals to take opportunities to think about the course that they want their lives to take, and to be able to, with the help of their physician and family, make the kinds of decisions about how they want the ends of their lives to be at the point before those questions can't be asked any longer.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about the image of the physician in American society. My guests were Nancy King and Larry Churchill of the Department of Social and Administrative Medicine at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Nancy King and Larry Churchill participated in a symposium at the University of North Carolina entitled The Physician as Captain of the Ship, a Critical Reappraisal of the Physician's Role in American Culture. Among the topics for discussion were the physician and technological change, bioethics, the marketing of modern healthcare, and nursing and the profession of medicine. For a cassette copy of Soundings on the Image of the Physician in American Society, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about the origins and development of the novel. My guests will be Robert Terhorst of the University of Arizona and Paul Hunter of the University of Rochester. Robert Terhorst and Paul Hunter recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center, where each worked on a project about the development of modern fiction. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for a discussion about images of the physician in American culture. Until recently, doctors were captains of the ship. But today, owing in part to consumer choice, along with technological, legal, and economic considerations, the social mandate of American medicine is clearly changing. Images of the physician. Some answers and insights from two members of the medical faculty at the University of North Carolina, this week on Soundings, from the National Humanities Center on this station.